This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vaslash, episode 457 for March 22nd, 2019. The amazing heritage of General Motors. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or on YouTube.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
Thanks for joining us. John's not here, so in order to make this a great show, I had to bring in two of my good friends who are very knowledgeable about the auto industry.
Good friends?
Good friends.
Oh. Good friends?
That's Craig Cole of AutoGuide.com, who is to automotive journalism what Ota Kringer is to good, delicious beverages.
And we have an inside joke.
And we have James Amend of WardsAuto.com. And, you know, I was thinking, James, you used to cover Wall Street. So, we often talk about, the business of the business. Mm-hmm. You're probably the only one who actually knows anything about that.
Yeah.
And so
I like to think that.
So
good stock tips.
Or something like
that,
right?
Nothing I can share without getting in trouble with the SEC.
That's right, and we don't want that to happen. And we have Greg Wallace, who was formerly in charge of the GM Heritage Center. And so now that you know the cast of characters that we have here, I would like to urge all of you to get questions in. And to do so, you can give us a call at 620-288-6546. That's 620-288-6546. You can send us an email at viewermail, all long word of viewermail, at autoline.tv or via the YouTube chat. So, get them. We'll get the questions going here. And so, Greg, the GM Heritage Center, what is it?
It's a culmination of all the best things that General Motors has done from a standpoint of design, from popularity. It serves three purposes. One, it serves as a styling reference center, engineering reference center, and we do events there. Do roughly 300 events at the Heritage Center per year. It has an ambiance that is different than any other place that you might hold an event at. We're set up for up to 500 people at an event, and it's been a really popular place for that.
So you have historic cars throughout the history of General Motors. Is that?
We have roughly 700 cars in our collection. And that represent all of the different brands within General Motors. And so all the high water marks, we highlighted some of the vehicles as crown jewels of our collection. The 1931 Cadillac V16 that we have is one of our crown jewels, yep.
Showstopper.
And it shows also set up for an event there that we're having that night. But, the 31 is an interesting vehicle. It's been a Cadillac since 1975 and came to us from the original owner. And she had inherited a large sum of money, went out and bought herself that car. And in 1931, at the height of the Depression, that was a $7,000 car at the time. So it was quite a bit of moxie to buy something like that during then. And so she wanted it to go back to General Motors. And so in 1975... Cadillac figured out how to get it back, and we've had it ever since. It's one of our...
Buy a lot of Model A's for that price.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, it was a great vehicle. A lot of firsts on that. The first
V16. Yep. It's a 452 cubic inch. Mm-hmm. And things you take for granted that we have in automobile engines today, such as hydraulic valve lifters and harmonic balancers and thermostatically controlled cooling systems. That's all stuff that is on this vehicle. And it's a 100-mile-an-hour car. Mm-hmm. If you've ever been in a Model A, they're stretching their legs at 50. So, it's quite a car.
Didn't Cadillac build two different generations of V16? Am I wrong?
You're absolutely right. Oh. We built the first generation, which was the 452 cubic inch, which is a 45-degree V.
Okay.
And then we built a 135-degree V, which is almost opposing. 431 cubic inch V16, but it only ran for from 38 to 40, so only 500 and some cars were built. It's definitely one of those cars that was very niche marketed.
Mm-hmm.
We were offering 50 different body styles at the time, over 500 different color combinations. In the catalog, there were a lot of cars that just simply weren't built, you know, so they built so few of those cars. Mm.
So Cadillac used to be known as the standard of the world. How come?
Standardization of automobile parts. Most of the manufactured goods at the time had select fit, which meant if you broke a hub off of something, you got a new hub, but you had to file and fit it to make it fit again. Whereas Henry Lindland, the founder of Cadillac, also known even at that time as the master of precision, come up with a way via go and no-go gauges in the Johansson gauge blocks to have all the parts interchangeable. Mm. And it was widely thought impossible. So in 1908, Cadillac proved it out by disassembling three cars under the watchful eye of the Royal Automobile Club. And they jumbled all them parts together. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then it was all put back together. And then they all completed a 500-mile test run on the Brooklands Raceway, which they all completed. This really wasn't an achievement, so the Dewar Cup was awarded to Cadillac for that achievement. And it was only, the Dewar Cup was only sort of like the Nobel Prize of Automotive Achievement at the time. It was only awarded for the most significant things. So the interesting part is Cadillac won it first for parts interchangeability, and then we won it a second time in 1912 for electric start. Mm.
The Dewar's Cup?
Dewar Cup.
There it is.
Full of scotch. Full of scotch.
Dewar's Scotch.
It was the same company?
Yes.
Yeah,
really?
I think it was, actually.
So we have a question here from Louis F. Fourier. I may have pronounced that, and I apologize. He's the president of the Society of Automotive Historians, and he says, Ford and most European manufacturers have opened their collections to the public. Why not GM?
This is something we wrestle with all the time. We're not open to the public, but generally we get more people through our collection than the public does. If you go to our website and key in the words General Motors Heritage Center, it'll take you to our website and you'll see how you can get in. And we entertain groups of 30 or more. And we get 25 to 30,000 people through our place at a year. Hmm. So it's not like it's closed off. But since we use it for so many internal things, it's hard to be open to the public if you're doing a new model announcement or doing an all-employee meeting of some sort. So we certainly aren't open to the public, but we certainly get enough people through there to make it.
How do you decide what gets... You said there's 700-some cars that you guys have. You don't even have all 700 of them on the floor at one time, do you?
No, we have roughly anywhere from 150 to 200 cars at any given time. It depends on what event we're doing. Sometimes we'll do a Corvette event and they'll request all Corvettes, so we'll go dig every Corvette we have out, have them out on the floor in chronological order, mm-hmm. or whatever order they're looking to have them in. So they're constantly churning. About 1,500 cars go in and out of our facility a year. So out of that 700 cars, they're constantly coming in and out.
Where do you store the overflow?
We have two other buildings. And two other buildings they're basically cheek to jowl, bumper to bumper, you know, covered up. And we can pick and choose and go get what we need.
Now, it was my understanding that a few years ago, GM pared back its collection. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is very correct.
How do you make a decision on what to keep and maybe what to send out into the public?
I got a call at 1:30 in the afternoon, and it told that we had to pare down our collection by over 500 cars. This was just before the financial issues that General Motors mm-hmm. had. So myself and a few other key people went in and looked at cars on a screen, and it quickly became apparent that when you have 60 2002 to 2006 Monte Carlos, that you can get rid of a few of them. For instance, we had three 1969 GTOs. Two of them were movie cars from the Demolition Man, and one was just a stock GTO. So we kept the best Demolition Man car. That was the 442s, but we kept the best of the W30s that we had and kept the best of the GTOs that we had, and we sold the rest. And the key to that was we found a way to sell them through, like, Bear Jackson and some of the other auctions to where people could actually buy them. I think the reason why the collection swells so much is we have a hard time scrapping these vehicles. You look at this thing, it's holy cow, this is such a beautiful vehicle. It just seems like such sacrilegious to scrap it. So that your collection swells pretty quickly with cars that aren't stock, aren't really of historic in nature. So today we go through those cars every year, and people like Mark Royce and Mike Simcoe from Design, we look at these cars and decide, well, is this a keeper or is it not? And that's how we keep it down to 700.
So to the issue of disposing of some of these cars, Barry Rector from Indianapolis says, I was at Barrett Jackson the year that GM sold a number of the museum cars. Do you know how many were sold? And this is perhaps is the more interesting part of the question is, are there any cars that you wish you had back?
I think we sold all the right cars that we needed to sell. Some of the SEMA vehicles that we let go are really interesting vehicles. They're no way historic in any way, shape. They've been modified so much, but they just, you know, if you're a car person, they're just so interesting. But I think we sold somewhere in and around 200 cars at Barrett Jackson that first year. And sort of an interesting story along with that is that, you know, it wasn't long after that they started asking for the valuation of all the rest of the vehicles that we had. So being the paranoid sort that I am, I started thinking, well, geez, they're thinking about paring off the rest of this collection. So I went to Whitaker, who was our leader at the time, and he was a Southern gentleman. And
Whitaker, Texan.
Yep. And told him that I was in fear of this and used the analogy of a family Bible. And ended up, I said, you can take your family Bible and throw it in the trash barrel, which I knew he'd understand what that meant, too. And you'll never get this collection back together like it is. Not only that, but if we would have flooded the market with that many high-quality cars, it would have brought the value. You would have got a lot of money for the first few and then little or more than what you expected out of the rest of them. So, but as far as cars that we got rid of, I think we got rid of all the right cars. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a favorite in the collection? Is there one car that you lust after the most?
You know, I grew up in the muscle car in the 70s, and so I would think that's primarily the cars I like. We've got a really nice 70 Nova L78 four-speed car. It's kind of a plain Jane car, which is kind of cool. 70 Chevelle, which are one of my favorites as well. As far as value goes, probably the most valuable vehicle we have in there production-wise is that 1911 Oldsmobile Limited.
That's the one that's like 15 feet tall, right? It's massive.
Huge. It's got 43-inch tall tires. Those are some real dubs there. But so, that's probably the most valuable car, and I don't think there's more than three or four of them left in the world today.
Wow.
And Oldsmobile kept that car. Mm-hmm. So we always had it.
So Chuck Grenchy wants to know, of the 700 cars in the collection, how many are in running condition?
If they ever ran, they still run.
Really?
We really put into a lot of effort to get all the cars, evaluate them, figure out whether they ever did run at one time. We've had some cars that they built, styling concept cars. They never ran, and they never were intended to run. But even our gas turbine cars, we brought back up to running order. Everything in there runs.
What about the expense of keeping these vehicles around? You mentioned you have to keep them in running condition. I have to imagine that it's not a very inexpensive endeavor.
And it is. We got talented people that's their job. Day in and day out to keep those cars running. I was involved with that as well, making sure that we kept the cars running. But there's expense to it, but I think it's well worth it when you look at the value that it provides to people that come into General Motors and really don't know much about General Motors. It's not a lot of automobile companies out there that can tout a history that GM can. Mm-hmm. It's very valuable, and GM uses it quite a bit to tout. It's hard to know where you're going if you don't know where you've been.
Yeah, I know. And Dan Ammon, I think he mentioned to me one time when we were talking, you know, your former president of General Motors, now over at Cruise Automation. He talked about how, and he was a car guy too to begin with, but going in there and getting indoctrinated, so to speak, in GM's history with things that you can really put your hands on. And I know we attend press events there sometimes, mm-hmm. and it's just spectacular to see. Just it runs the gamut.
Yeah, most of the GM executives have been through, and I do two different tours. You know, if you have no interest in cars, I can still make you interested in.
Why are you working at GM then?
if you have an interest in cars, we have two other kind of specific tours that we do. One is engineering tours, so where we point out the innovations and that kind of stuff, and then the other is the design. Mm-hmm. You can go around and point out some of the things that GM is known for, industry leading in design. And, you know, it's interesting when you look at our cars we come out with today, you can usually find some hint of DNA to the past. And I think the Heritage Center is directly
involved. So certainly one of the most influential automotive designs in the history of General Motors has to be the Buick Y-Job that Harley Earl did. Do you guys have one of those?
We have the Buick Y-Job, the one and only. And, yeah, you're right. When you look at the Y-Job and then you look at the current production vehicle, the 38 and 39 Buicks, they're very tall cars. They're made for people with top hats. And you look at the Buick Y-Job, and it's very low to the ground. Very stylistic. Notice that the fenders are now incorporated into the body. Got a lot of aircraft-inspired design, pontoon-style fenders, windstrakes. Look at the windshield; is very aircraft-inspired. You get inside the car; it's very aircraft-inspired. So, that was the inspiration for automobile design back in the 30s. Was the aircraft? But that car is a good 10 years ahead of its time, as far as design goes.
So, arguably, it changed. It changed. The nature of cars going forward after that.
Absolutely. You know, it's the first notable concept car that Harley Earl did, but he did some other cars that were very interesting as well before that. He was known to do cars for Hollywood Elite, and he was working for a company called Donnelly at the time, and they would do cars for, you know, some of the Hollywood stars, you know, custom off, one-off cars.
There's Harley in the vehicle.
Yeah, that's, you know, he did all his own clinicking, you know, so he'd drive these cars out to some place where he knew there'd be a lot of public, and he'd mm-hmm. have a photographer there, and they'd pull up and just gauge what people's reaction was. Mm-hmm. And it was must have been overwhelmingly positive, because you can see a lot of 50s design, 40s and 50s design in GM cars, and then ultimately in the rest of the automobile industry as well. Notice how the tires are kind of small compared to a car from the 30s, you know. The road system was terrible back then, so you needed big, tall tires. As the road systems were getting better, you know, the smaller tires. Notice the gas turbine wheels on the car, the gas turbine-inspired design wheels on it. So that's a nod towards the future. Bomb sight style hood ornament, which became so popular on Buicks in the 50s.
Mm-hmm. Portholes yet.
No portholes
not
yet.
Quite yet.
Mm-hmm. That car is very drivable. It's got 50-some thousand miles on it. It's got the straight 8-cylinder engine, 50-some
miles. So it has been driven then.
Well, that was Harley's daily driver to work,
drove
right?
It a lot, yes. Wow. As many of our concept vehicles, even up through the Mitchell era, you know,
so there,
the
Mako
Sharks.
So it's a true concept car, not like a Rubbermaid tub like most modern concepts are. They can't drive, you can't take them anywhere, you push them on stage.
Just the way it is.
So I remember you did the Buick Blackhawk, too. GM did that, and that was kind of a nod to the Y-Job, wasn't it? That was,
absolutely,
you know, 20 years ago or so. That was an interesting looking. Hmm.
So I want to put two questions together, one from Baron and one from Ray Mitrowitz, because they sort of mesh. What is the procedure for a car to enter the Heritage Center, and are there current models out there now that you think will be Heritage Center material?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, if you look at any of the special Corvettes, we hang on to all the current model special Corvettes, some of the special edition Camaro Z28, Z01s and that kind of stuff. We hang on to those. You know, some of the Copo stuff. We built one Copo Camaro. We hung on to that. So, yeah, there's quite a bit of that. And, you know, we'll hang on to some of the Buicks, some of the milestone Buicks and GMCs and Chevy trucks as well.
Mm-hmm. Maybe a mid-engine Corvette, I imagine, would find its way in the Heritage Center very quickly.
The nice part about having somebody like Mark Royce there is he knows right away that we want to keep that. So, he looks out for us.
So here's a couple of sort of technical questions, one from B. Wilson for Webb and one from Kit Gerhardt, how do you deal with the aging of the tires, and do you keep the batteries charged or even batteries in the cars?
The batteries are the number one maintenance item on those cars. So what we do is there's only about five or six different style batteries when you're talking 12 volts. So we keep a bunch of those. We keep them hot to keep the cars going all the time. But tires, we use the GM product and do the tires. And since they're indoors and not so much in the sun and stuff, they last pretty good, believe it or not.
So when we showed a picture of the Heritage Center earlier in the show, there was the Firebird concept. The one that sort of looks like a rocket ship.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So tell us about that car a little bit. I mean, it was rather phenomenal. There it is on the...
The first Firebirds were some of the first alternate fuel vehicles, if you will. They ran on kerosene or anything that would sort of burn a little bit, whiskey or anything else. But it's gas turbine. And, believe it or not, that car, I think, did 231 miles an hour. Ooh. On a test track. It's very much like an aircraft. It's got air brakes on it, little flaps that come up when you put the brakes on. It's got a very similar to the Pontiac, later Pontiac, where the aluminum drum in the front acts as and disc brakes on the car, and it's all part of that hub. It's a very interesting car, and it runs very well. You see three fins on that by Firebird 3 with... had nine fins on it, I believe. So,
this one.
Yeah,
ew. It's a few too many fins.
So, is that version a turbine car?
It's
as
also
well?
A gas turbine car. Yep. What's also interesting about that car is, and it's way ahead of its time. It's got a joystick for control. In the center, you turn it right to go right, turn it left to go left, forward to go forward, and pull it back to brake. But there still is a hidden brake pedal on it, just in case you panic. The thing about gas turbine cars, they don't like cold weather, or these don't anyways. And you got to make your plans a little in advance when the engines are idling at 50,000 RPM. So you really have to plan out where you're going so you can keep it in the right range. Great generator motors, great engines for submarines and that kind of stuff. But for the automobile so far, it hasn't panned out.
Probably better at a constant speed, right?
Yes, something with constant speed.
So that car had two big fins that remind me of the Cadillac Eldorado, the 59. Do you guys have one of those?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a 59 Eldorado, Eldorado Barretts. That's one of our crown jewel cars as well.
Spectacular.
And, it's ahead of its time, too. It's a 125-mile-an-hour car, gas shock absorbers. It's got cruise control. Every window on it's powered. And it's got six-way seats, so it's a comfortable car even by today's standards. With these older cars, now our cars, we try to keep the correct style bias ply tires on them, which makes them crack hunters on the road. But if you put radial tires and gas shock absorbers on these older cars, they drive quite well.
And I think that was the vehicle that was in the Cadillac stand at the Detroit Auto Show and probably subsequent auto shows. I couldn't help but walk away from the Cadillac stand where they had all the new product, the current product, and just keep thinking about that Eldorado, because that was, even of any car that was at the Detroit Auto Show this year, that was clearly the star of the show.
North American International Auto Show, please. I give, Andrew Smith in the crew at Cadillac Design credit for putting that car in there, saying that we recognize and acknowledge our past. And this brings a question. Wright Knight 70 says, what do you think that the men who ran General Motors in the old days would think about the much smaller General Motors and lack of styling? I mean, that seems like very exaggerated. Many of these things we've seen so far, whether it's the Y Job or the Firebird. I mean, these were real broad expressions of imagination, and we don't see much of that anymore.
They didn't have aerodynamics or safety to contend with
right?
They just had made it look cool.
And that's part that is probably the biggest single thing. There were no rules, and whatever you did was okay. The 59 Eldorado, we've got letters in the archive someplace that talks about people running into that point, and in impaling themselves. So when you look at General Motors took all that stuff for safety very seriously at the time. So the 60 Cadillac has got a very subdued fin compared to the 59. But you know, things like you know, there's all, everything's rigidly built. You know, there's a famous commercial out there where they show a 59 Chevrolet going into the barrier, three-quarter barrier, and then they show a new Malibu. You know, you get out of the Malibu and you're not uninjured. You know, this 59 Chevy blew to pieces, you know, and it's like, so they don't build cars like they used to, so thank God. So from a safety standpoint, the cars are far superior than they were.
So, you know, you're talking about the turbine engines in vehicles. And one of the things that's going on right now is the electrification of vehicles. Now, you guys have a Corvair that was an electric car from back in the day. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we have a, what they call the Electrovair. And the Electrovair is, has the silver zinc batteries, which was the lithium ion of the day. And it's a lot like your old Makita electric drills. When it starts getting low, it just goes slower. And so it had a stack of batteries. It was very functional. You'd get about 80 miles out of the thing. So it was very functional as far as that goes. But it's the same, you know, battery technology is the key to electric cars. And so we also have a hydrogen-powered van, which I think is, yeah, there it is. And it's got a hydrogen power plant in it that keeps the batteries charged, and it's operational as well. Pretty
fuel cell. It's burning the hydrogen to charge the batteries.
Yes,
then,
yeah.
So, were these vehicles done as just proof of concept, or were they done thinking like, okay, maybe we'll make one someday?
I think they were done as look what we can do that nobody else can do. You know, I mean, there was nothing else like that during that period of time. And it's just, you know, it was a testimony to the research power that General Motors had. So, yeah, and we've got moving film footage. If you go to our website, you can look up moving film footage of these cars in action.
So we have another question here from Marty Boyle Davis saying, with the changes in the industry today, do you discern any attitudes and perspectives within today's General Motors that hearken to the past?
I don't know that I can answer that question, really. I just I think there's a certain role, a certain passion that comes along that you still see, and without that passion, you know. It's not the automobile.
So people like Mark Royce.
Yeah, Mark Royce, I think, would be the best example of in the industry of someone who's
absolutely. Mark's got the
passion.
And most of the upper management does. Most of the guys, they have vintage cars and hot rods and stuff. They're car people.
Right.
We have a car show at the Tech Center every year. It's an employee car show. We allow outsiders to come in as well, but you want to see some car people that work at General Motors go to that car show.
Yeah.
And, you know, just to build off that, what do you think the future of, you know, the classic car? You're very close to that. What is the future of that with baby boomers are getting older? Those are the people that gave rise to this movement. Millennials are coming along. Is there a future, or will it be a different classic car that the person wants to collect?
I think you're going to have different categories of car collecting. You know, the 57 Chevy was the 55 Chevy was the you know, the classic car of choice for many of the older set like myself. You know, for the younger people, you see they're gravitating to some of the Hondas and some of the Cobalts, supercharged Cobalts, and that kind of stuff. You're starting to see those around, and so it's just going to be a different group. And a lot of the younger kids are starting to embrace the 50s cars. They think that, you know, retro is cool. And when you start looking at these cars, there's, you know, it's no denying that a 57 Chevy is still a good looking car.
Well, speaking of cool, Greg Wallace, we want to thank you for being on the show and sharing your insights about what's going on at the GM Heritage Center, and it looks like a really phenomenal place. So people ought to, like, put together some sort of an event so they can get in there.
Absolutely. Go to our website, gmheritagecenter.com, and you'll get all the information there that you'll want on our cars.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us today. And
thanks for having
me. Now we're going to take a quick break and hear from our sponsors.
The world is changing at an ever-increasing pace. No matter what the mode of transportation, there is always the need for an efficient propulsion system. And that's exactly what BorgWarner has been doing since the earliest days of the automotive industry. We create innovative mobility technologies that reduce energy consumption and emissions while improving performance. Our proven track record has made us an industry leader in forward-looking propulsion solutions for combustion, hybrid, and electric vehicles.
Lear Kinexis offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
And we're back with Craig Cole, AutoGuide.com.
I believe you called me a good friend.
My good friend, Craig Cole.
I'm touched, Gary. I never knew we were on that level.
Okay, but the show isn't over yet, and so that may change.
I still have plenty of time to screw things up.
Yeah, that was a very emotional moment.
I was in
James Amend of WordsAuto.com. So you guys thought it would be easy, but now it's time for the Dr. Data segment of the
show. Baring his teeth.
And so you guys are going to have to use that gray matter that that you have there.
Just go now, because this is too much.
So, okay. So, it's James, you brought up the millennials, okay? And so the people at Quote Wizard, which look at car insurance and what people are getting, have come up with what millennials are driving. So, Katie, could you please bring up the first? So, I want you guys to name the top five cars driven by millennials, okay? Now, I'm going to give you some help, because I know that would be a very difficult thing to do solo. So, here is a list of 10 vehicles. They're not in the order of the top five, and I would like you to tell me what the top five might be.
Camry, Corolla, Civic, Accord, Focus.
Camry,
those are all
Corolla.
That were handed down from your
Civic,
parents. That's a good point.
Camry, Corolla, Civic. What were the other two? Accord.
Atlas, Sierra.
Accord. And what was your fifth one?
I had Camry, Corolla, Civic, Accord, Focus.
Focus. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Cole, do you...
It's got to be Corolla because they last forever. Civic behind that, probably Camry. I'm going to say Grand Cherokee.
I like that pick.
And is that four?
That is four.
I don't do well with numbers.
You don't do numbers at all.
And then Impala, just because why not? It's a full-size car, right? If you don't have a family, you've got enough space to start one in the back seat.
I was a little taken aback, you know. I mean, it's a good thing this is after hours because, you know, that was a little risque.
I'll tap it down. All right, that wouldn't fly during daytime.
Yeah, that's true. So Katie, please bring up the answer here. So here we have the top five, and that is in order.
Completely wrong.
So let's see. We had James had the Accord, and he had the Civic. Nobody had the Altima.
Who's number two?
Camry, and nobody had the Sonata.
Sonata surprises me, but
so then we'll show the entire list. Katie, please. So that's the entire list. So the Impala is actually six. You were close on that, Craig. But
wow.
According to the people at Quote Wizard, one of the issues is that the average MSRP of the top 10 cars driven by millennials is $23,829, and given the fact that they are on in debt.
Yes.
On the order of $36,000. Mm-hmm. This is why. But, you know, didn't it come as a surprise to you guys that there are not a whole lot of crossovers on that list?
Yeah, because that's all that people are buying, right? Or
right.
Supposedly.
So basically, I mean, and there's no indication that these are used cars. I mean, these are what people are presumably buying. So what does that do to the whole crossover thing? There's Grand Cherokee is the only one on the list.
Well, I mean, it's all generational, right? Minivans were amazingly popular back when Chrysler first came out with them, and for a number of years after the initial introduction. But nobody wants to drive what their parents drove, right? So I think we're going to get to a point where crossovers are uncool, because what kid is going to want to drive what their parents had? So maybe they're going to go to a sedan or want a sedan that's more stylish, more interesting, something different.
So
we might see a revival.
So you think there'll be a revival of
possibly
the family sedan?
It could be. I mean, the design has to be there.
You're
the
with,
technology.
You're with AutoGuide.com. Come on, let's.
I'm thinking out loud.
Make a bold statement here.
I would think the list
trails. It's like, you know, perception trailing reality. I think the list trails what's currently popular in the marketplace.
Well, these guys are looking at what people are getting insurance quotes on.
So that
would be like, I want to insure an Accord, right?
Yeah, you still have to get a quote on a
right,
used car.
Right, but so either way. But I mean, so this week Ford announced that they're increasing the production at the Kentucky truck plant for building more giant expeditions. And, you know, the demand has gone way up for, you know, what is arguably a family car, and then the Lux version of that, the Lincoln Navigator. So is you know, what are we not seeing here? Or what are you not seeing here?
I don't know. I wear glasses.
Yes,
I
mean, that's very true.
Well, I don't know. I do. This is out of left field, but I do enjoy there's a new commercial out there for the Expedition where there's the family occupying the first two rows, and then the cousins and the uncles are in the third row. Because the camera's panning back from the front of the vehicle, and then there's a horse trailer that they're pulling, and I think that's exactly what we're seeing is
because Americans buy vehicles for the one time they need the 7-passenger seating or the 8-passenger seating, right? I think in Europe you buy a Golf, and that's your primary car, and if you need something bigger one time a year, you go and rent something, right? America, we want something giant that can do anything whenever we want at the drop of a hat. And an Expedition or something similar can do that. You've got three rows of seats. You've got tons of towing capacity. You've got a lot of cargo room. And it's super versatile. Now, you see one person driving one of those to work in the morning, right?
It's questionable. It's always
why the hell do you need that?
So we see around here one person behind the wheel of an Expedition. But yeah, the family is back, and I think that's leading to the popularity of that.
All right, so let me throw this out there.
It's a very active family these days too.
They don't sell cars to inactive families. Exactly, they never mention the inactive family.
Right. So this sort of might put a kibosh on your notion of the sedan. This is numbers from LMC, which said that globally, the SUV in 2018 had a global market share of 31%, which trounced on its next competitor, which is the hatchback, which was 6 points lower.
Wow.
So explain that to me.
I don't know.
I think you can.
I don't. I guess people are prioritizing style over classic proportions and styling. I mean, and the sedan form, right? And efficiency. I don't know.
That's what you're saying? That's what you're living in?
You're not buying it, Gary.
I'm buying it.
He's very incredulous.
Yes. So James, so you cover General Motors, and
I try.
So I saw that this week the company announced it's going to be investing $2.7 billion into two facilities in Brazil. Could there be worse timing for them to make that announcement?
In what context?
In the
turmoil in South America, or the fact that they're not investing in North America yet they invest in South America?
Yes.
So the latter.
This past weekend, they were rather taken to the woodshed
by Donald Trump, who I don't know how much he knows about the auto industry and the way it works.
And yesterday in Lima, Ohio, when he was making his speech.
Right.
And
when is the timing good? We know the industry, and we know that those investments, it's some more than others. And we know it's a global business.
My good friend here is
honesty is important. You should try it.
But this is a global business, and that's an investment that's being made in a country where, I mean, they're not going to be exporting out of South America. That's a local investment for a local market, and if anyone tries to argue it otherwise, they don't grasp how this industry works, and that it's a global industry. And I do think it's interesting. If I'm not mistaken, I mean, this investment was put on the table in 2014. And, you know, there's been some political turmoil, obviously, in Brazil. They can't keep their leaders out of jail. And there's a lot of graft and corruption. And now they've got a very
Venezuela, Trump, maybe.
Yeah, well, they've got a very Trump-like leader now. He was a former talk show host. But anyway, the point is,
home over or Trump-like sort of belligerent?
Maybe a little of both. Okay. But he's so now Brazil's back on the front burner. And GM needs to make investments down there because they have a lot of legacy product and they need to get new product in there. I think they have the leading market share.
But is Brazil still a developing market, or is it matured to the point where...
Well, it's never really had a chance to mature because they've had chronic inflation. You know, we've been waiting for these people. You know, they express interest in new vehicles. So... this time around, maybe this is the emerging market. Maybe it finally comes into its own. As it was, remember, BRIC in Brazil was the V. It was supposed to lead the way.
This was Brazil, Russia, India, China.
Yeah, and they just need to fix their economy, get their inflation under control.
Just
and there's also currency headwinds that you run into down there. There's a poor. Exchange rate, so there are definitely still challenges down there, but maybe this time Brazil emerges, and that's so, what this investment is.
So sticking with General Motors, so there's some rumors that they may be selling the Lordstown plant. Have you gotten any info on that?
I saw something come out of what is it, the Vindicator? The Vindicator down in down in Ohio about that. So no, I don't have any intelligence to add to that. I, you know, other than Trump asking them to do it. I think the more progress is being made in Oshawa, where Jerry Diaz, the head of Unifor, is saying that he's suddenly optimistic about retaining jobs there after a meeting in Detroit a few days ago.
What would they build there?
That's a good question.
More trucks?
That's a good question. But when the union leader comes out and says he's optimistic, when you've run a campaign, including Super Bowl commercials, criticizing GM for pulling out of Oshawa, and then you stop that campaign, signals that there's something going on.
So we heard the president yesterday basically saying that one of the reasons you mentioned the union and in his presentation in Lima yesterday, he was saying one of the problems with Lordstown was that union dues were too high.
And he's in a union shop making these announcements, making these proclamations.
But union dues, what? You paid the dues to the union, like that's...
But the question is that... Was it that made it too expensive to make Chevy Cruzes, or was it that people weren't buying Chevy Cruzes?
They weren't buying the car, right?
I mean, but
I'm just asking.
I know. I don't mean to. But people keep asking this question. You know, why is it unallocated? Why doesn't it have product? And the simple fact is the market turned on a dime. And they're making a product that you can't sell
at a profit, at least.
Yeah. And that's the old General Motors maybe would have stuck it out. The new General Motors is not going to stick it out. Hopefully, they do get some product in there.
Do you think it's likely that they're going to get product in there? I mean, you cover this company, so I mean, yeah, I'm putting you on the spot. But
what do you think, Gary? We're not hearing much out of you.
I think that's...
I'm asking the question.
I think that's a difficult question because you look at the capacity of Lordstown and...
It's a giant plant.
I mean, you know, where are you going to get that? Where are you going to get that? How are you going to put that capacity into a marketplace that is contracting?
Right.
So near term, I don't... I would say
maybe
the future
Tesla
is not.
Can build batteries. Right.
Well, see, I was wondering, isn't Spring Hill the only plant that they mothballed and then brought back?
Yeah, because you know they Janesville was taken down.
But I mean, it never came back.
Never came back. Shreveport was taken down. Never came back.
Didn't they sell that to that company that makes the three? Yeah. LEO.
Yeah. Yeah, LEO Motors. Yeah. And I think that's a good lesson in Trump was asking them to sell the plant. And I think that protracted process of unloading Shreveport should serve as a lesson to how they're going to deal with Lordstown.
So tell us about that.
Well, it's just too long of a process. It's okay. A long, costly process. Don't do it that way.
All right. So sort of, and now I'm like really reaching. And I know that comes as a surprise to my good friend Craig, but so there's a company that I had not been familiar with called Evelocity, which I was surprised to learn consists of a bunch of guys who used to work for Faraday Future. Okay, yep. So you've
is
got
this
the,
another electromobility.
This is an electromobility company. Okay, so but listen to this. I mean, this is really impressive. So
is
here's
it?
The here's this guy Ulrich Kranz, who is in charge of technology for Evelocity. He used to be the chief technology officer of Faraday Future, but before that, he spent 30 years at BMW, including in charge of the i3 and the i8. You have Richard Kim at Evelocity, who is in charge of design. He had been the VP of design at Faraday, but he was the design manager at the VW Audio Studio in Santa Monica, and he was, oh, by the way, the lead exterior designer for the BMW i3.
Hmm.
And, you know, and then you've got, and you'll be familiar with this guy, Carl Thomas Neumann, who is in charge of mobility for the company, and he was the former CEO of Opel.
KT.
So it sounds like they got all these real guys.
Well, got a big investment, and they spent it all on bringing good talent in.
Right, but so these guys leave Faraday, and they start this new company, which apparently is funded. And reporting was this week that they are talking to Magna Steyr about building vehicles in the United States. Now, Magna Steyr, for those who are not familiar, is a contract manufacturer, and they make Jaguars and Toyotas and Mercedes and BMWs. And I mean, and these are like the new Supra is going to be made by Magna Steyr, and the Jaguar
I-Pace
is being made, you know, electric car, right? I mean,
very good electric.
So is it possible that, say, people at Magna Steyr would say, let's buy Lordstown.
Anything's possible.
Well,
but is Magna Steyr going to build cars in the U.S. or are they going to be like a consultant to teach?
No, they want them to build.
Company? They want them to build the cars here.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, they did. Okay, so Tesla took over Fremont, which itself was a huge assembly plant, right?
Like one of the biggest in the world, wasn't it?
And so. It's plausible. You just don't use all the square footage, right? I guess because Lordstown is a city in itself. But I can't imagine anybody again adding capacity.
Right, but I mean the capacity exists there, and they want these cars. You know, because I mean the Tesla thing. If you think about it, if we roll back the clock, I mean that basically happened during the recession when General Motors decided that it didn't want NUMMI anymore, and Toyota was. You know, working with Tesla. In fact, it was using Tesla batteries initially in the RAV4 EV. And so I think it was one of these deals where Toyota's like left with this and they're like, what the heck? Let's give it to Tesla for, you know.
This is the kind of context that a host needs to bring to a show.
Is it?
That was awesome.
I'll try to work on that.
That was good. That was good. Because you're right. We're in unusual circumstances today too. But I can't imagine why Magna would want to at least... Surely not brick and mortar, and I know AM General's been mentioned in the mix, and they would seem like more, just to me, you know, just speculating would be more of a, they'd have this sort of incremental capacity increase that this less than 1% of the market would be.
So AM General being the company that was building the Hummer for a while
for
General Motors under contract went to Hummer, and but then they make the real Humvee vehicle, and so they have
and they're in the
contract.
US.
Yeah. Knowledge in terms of manufacturing stuff.
And they're in the U.S., and they're these cars are going to be sold in the U.S., if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to be exported. My two cents.
So Switching gears, as we like to say in the automotive world.
That's a nice transition.
Do you like that?
What if it's a CVT? What you...
That's right, yeah. Continuously variable. So one of the companies that seems to be on a roll here is PSA, the French automotive conglomerate. And apparently the Peugeot family still owns a piece of the action.
Like the Ford family,
like
I guess.
Like the Ford family, yeah. Exactly right. And so Carlos Tavares apparently got an okay from the Peugeot family to go out and perhaps find a company to acquire. And now, given the fact that, again, back to your knowledge there, James, that in 2017, PSA bought Opel Vauxhall from General Motors. So I put it to both of you guys. What could PSA likely acquire?
In the global auto space?
In the global auto space. And they are talking about coming back to the U.S. market, by the way. So
that's a tough question. Maybe they can... I don't know. Like, what's worth buying, right? Like, what... Or
how about
could
Fiat
be bought.
Chrysler?
Sure. They could, I guess. Or just break Ram and Jeep off, right?
Well, Fiat Chrysler makes the most sense because PSA is a Eurocentric automaker with no presence in the U.S., and you have Ram and Jeep, which are profit machines.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I've seen this movie before, and Manley didn't shoot it down. But
okay, but to the point that General Motors was losing money year after year after year in Europe, right? And PSA buys it and brings to profitability, right? So clearly these guys know something about doing this sort of thing.
Or they had some government backing or something that we don't know about. I don't know what the whole story is, but...
James does. Just ask him.
I would... You know, a lot of it, I think it's Tavares. I think he's able to work his way. He's proven he's a good he manages the unions well and that's what you need to do over there and gets the cost down and obviously was successful with Opel.
Mm-hmm. All right, Mr. Cole, since you've been sitting here and not answering questions,
that's my job. I make fun of things.
Yes. So apparently the CEO of Volvo, Håkan Samuelsson,
very Swedish,
told Reuters that he thinks that by 2025, and I believe this was reported on Autoline Daily, watch it if you don't watch Autoline Daily. It's a shout out to my friend Sean sitting back there, that he thinks that the margins on EVs will be the same as cars powered by internal combustion engines by 2025. You knew the answer.
Well, you said it earlier.
Oh, what do you think?
Well, battery technology is the big hurdle, right? I mean, it costs a lot of money to have a battery pack that delivers a decent range that's comparable to an internal combustion-powered car. And to say the profit margin would be the same on a vehicle that's pure electric versus gasoline, I don't think that's going to happen in 6 years. I'd like to be wrong, but I would say no. He's wrong.
He's wrong.
I'm going to put my flag in the sand.
Mm-hmm. No. No way.
No way that it's going to be, no. The margins are going to be the same?
I don't know. What. Maybe he's got a more accurate cost curve than I do, but I just don't see the technology. People aren't buying them, and that's what it's going to take.
Mm-hmm.
And until they start buying them and buying them in high numbers, that's when the costs are going to come down.
But is it fair to say that, okay, people are not buying them, but how many of them are there to buy?
You're saying it's a chicken and the egg problem of sorts? There's not enough choice?
Okay, so, I mean, it's like, okay, Tesla is doing phenomenally well in terms of units sold. I'm not talking about profitability or anything like that, right? And why is that? Because it's a special car, right? Then you have the Chevy Bolt EV.
Mm-hmm.
And then pretty much everything else is just a version of a car that has an internal combustion engine otherwise.
The I-Pace is excellent, right?
Yeah.
That's phenomenal.
But the I-Pace is pretty much like the E-Pace, right?
No, aren't they totally different?
No, they're both
hatchback-ish.
Crossover things.
Yeah. But I thought they were completely different architectures.
Well, I'll give you that one. Okay. All right.
Well, I think we're also speaking dynamically speaking, it's one of the best EVs.
Oh, yeah.
Not the best.
No, but my point is that if there's a whole bunch of...
cross right now.
Yeah. I'm not cross.
You're gesticulating a lot, Gary.
I'm doing a Beto O'Rourke imitation.
Beto O'Rourke, all right.
I'm trying to keep it fresh and contemporary. But my point is if Volkswagen is going to roll out with, 70 EVs in the next 10 years or whatever the number is, right? And so suddenly they're going to be maybe more appealing cars that you cannot buy with a gasoline engine. And therefore, I'm not so sure that these low numbers of EV sales are indicative of what the real market is because, you have such a limited choice now.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, anything's possible.
Well, I think
thanks for the validation. Right?
Well, yeah, and we have to kind of step out of our North America focus, which is full-size trucks and SUVs and very little as far as a charging infrastructure, a very mature market, a very mature infrastructure, gasoline infrastructure, and kind of think about things that are going on in China where you're building roads, you're building your infrastructure now. So, yeah, build more, and you can satisfy demand in these areas. But I still think
there'll be demand in these areas, meaning like Farmington Hills, Michigan.
That's where I think demand is. That's where demand is not, I think.
Is there a compelling reason to switch?
Switch what?
From a combustion-powered vehicle. If you're the average consumer that drives a Nissan Altima or whatever, is there a compelling reason to switch from that to an EV?
I'm asking the questions here.
I'm asking
you. Well, in the United States, you would say no because there's nowhere to charge it.
We
but
have
if
miles
you were
and miles
building
and
out,
miles and miles in,
if
in
you were
the
building out an infrastructure from scratch, then you could probably take that capacity that you're talking about.
Well, Electrify America is building out an infrastructure. And there are any number of if we were to pull out our cell phones and put in EV charging stations, we would see that
all over the place. Can our electrical grid support hundreds of thousands of EVs either?
Do I look like an electrical engineer?
I'm just throwing that out there, Gary. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe the Swedish gentleman over at Volvo, maybe he knows something about the technology that's working, the lithium, saltwater, diesel fuel, mayonnaise
battery that's coming out. There was one point that Volkswagen made. Dr. Dies said that basically it took less labor, like 30% less to assemble one of these cars, so you're taking some of the money out.
Manpower is a very costly.
So think about it. You don't need a traditional cooling system with an EV. There's no fuel system. There are all these systems you can take out of the vehicle. Mm-hmm. There aren't moving valves and keepers and valve springs and retainers. There's no crankshaft. There's no camshaft. No. How many parts, moving components are in a timing chain? You don't need any of that.
Well, no, from having rebuilt your famous Ford engine.
Which doesn't have a timing chain.
All right.
I see. You're trying to segue to the previous episode.
I'm just trying to make people want to look at the show that you were on the last time.
They should.
If
you want to learn about flathead V8s, check that one out. Mm-hmm. What episode number was that,
well,
Gary?
I'm not quite sure.
He doesn't know. I'm shocked. Shocked.
But I think you have the ride-hailing fleets now that want them to. So, I mean, there's a lot of it that goes into, growing the numbers of them sold. But 2025, I think, is optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so this will be the final question.
Oh, thank goodness.
And it'll be to you, James. so you mentioned Dan Amen earlier, who is now the president of GM Cruise, which is their autonomous vehicle development operation, and they are talking about having an autonomous fleet running in San Francisco by year end.
Mm-hmm. I think that's his answer right there.
Mm-hmm. How big is your fleet? Where is it going? I think you can say a lot of things. You can make a lot of bold statements that are very general in nature, but I will say for General Motors, they've pushed their chips to the center of the table on this, and they're going to be They're going to be very aggressive, but Mary Baer has been pretty clear that she also they're going to be safety is going to gate anything that they put out there. But yeah, I think by the end of the year they will. I mean, they're already on the streets.
All right. So, but
they're
but
doing.
But I'm talking about a commercial fleet, not just a test fleet of cars running around.
Commercial fleet for sale, or commercial fleet like commercial like delivery vehicles? What do you mean commercial?
Well, vehicles that are not just being used for experimental purposes only.
I think they could put them into a you know, complement part of Lyft's fleet or something like that. Sure, I think that could happen. Maybe GM runs its own fleet. They certainly have the ability to do that.
Mm-hmm. By the end of this year.
I don't see why they couldn't do it, but it's a matter of what sort of penetration is it.
So you're talking about, like, large. Basically three cars that are... You were sort of implying that, wasn't he?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I'm not.
This is in San Francisco, you said?
Yes.
Are the autonomous cars going to navigate Lombardy, or is it Lombard Street?
World's allegedly.
If they can do that, then I think these autonomous things are really...
I think it's a matter of steering, and there's, like, nothing, you know, it's a one-way street.
It's downhill.
Why would that be a problem?
Because it's got a lot of turns, and there are a lot of pedestrians, right?
Well, it's going to have to be a geofenced area, and it's going to be a regular route, and... Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I think, you know, Aptiv, you know, the former Delphi technology supplier, they're doing it right now in Las Vegas. You can ride hail an autonomous car. It has a human monitor behind the wheel to take over in case something happens. So that's something else to think about.
It's like Super Cruise.
When you're deploying this fleet by 2019, you know. Will there be a human monitor?
So what's the point? I mean, if you have this thing rolling around and the guy sitting there?
You know, it's a very good question.
You know, it's just, you know, driving over to the studio today, I saw a school bus driving down the 275, and I was thinking to myself, when are we going to have autonomous school buses? Would we ever trust a school bus full of children?
That's the ultimate autonomy. That's like when autonomy has fully arrived, when you have the school bus running, right?
Isn't that the case, though?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No?
Kids will not get on an autonomous school bus because we have the
they won't be in school by the time they come out.
That's true too. As a parent, I wouldn't see that happening. Besides, I have my kids have the best bus driver on the planet right now. So,
is that you? You got your license back?
No, Mrs. Okay. Sanderson. She's okay. Awesome.
All right, we're going to end it there. And according to the control room, I'm supposed to say nice things about MSU basketball, but I don't know anything. I don't know anything about that. And
I know that before I came in here, I checked my phone. We're two games in, and I'm 0-2 on my brackets. And
how you doing on your brackets?
Go sports.
Go sports.
Yeah.
What are the sports?
I don't know.
Oh,
I don't follow any.
And what did you lose?
What did I lose? Well, my whole family filled out brackets.
No, I don't care about your family. I want to know about what teams. Okay,
it's very pointed.
I am.
I didn't have any money. We don't have any money in the game.
I'm not talking about money. Just you
oh, which games did I lose? I'm sorry. I lost Minnesota and Maryland. I had Maryland over Minnesota. And I took Yale.
Okay, so I just want you all to know the reason I asked this question was that we asked James all of these other questions about what's going on in the auto industry. 0-2 in his brackets. So for those of you who are thinking about investing in any of the companies that he discussed here, take a grain of salt. So anyway, with that, my good friend Craig Hull from AutoGuide.com.
That's it. Thank you, Gary.
It's
a pleasure,
long
as
word,
always.
AutoGuide.com. You can see your sterling work there. As refreshing as an OTA.
I got to get you a case of that somehow.
James Amend. WardsAuto.com. And Wards Intelligence, or is that just the other guys, not you?
A little bit of both.
A little bit of both.
Yep.
So WardsAuto.com, and they can find you.
Right on. And go blue.
Go blue.
Mm.
Go sports.
That's right. I'm a professional sportser.
Okay.
I do the sports thing.
All right. With that, thank all of you for spending your time with us today.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires. Your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons, get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.